Next case on our docket is 22-60008, Consumers Research versus Federal Communications Commission. Mr. McCotter.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. In a non-delegation challenge, what suffices for an intelligible principle turns on the nature and the scope of the power delegated. Here, that's the power to decide how much money to raise for a nationwide social program. Supreme Court precedent indicates that in these circumstances, at least some kind of objective limit is required to guard against the executive's ability to raise money, like the caps that we saw in Skinner or J.W. Hampton. However, for the Universal Service Fund, there are no such express caps, nor are there any meaningful, clearly delineated, implied caps. For example, this court has held repeatedly that the Section 254B principles are aspirational only. In Section 254C, Congress gave essentially a non-definition of universal service, saying it's only an evolving standard. And perhaps most noteworthy, Congress allows the FCC both to redefine universal service and also to add new universal service principles, a rare multi-layer delegation not seen since the time of Schechter Poultry. There are no clear boundaries on the FCC's power to raise money, as confirmed by the skyrocketing rates. No wonder scholars have said that this particular scheme is unique in the statute books, and if replicated across the executive branch, would lead to a self-funding, unaccountable executive. Now, that's even before we get to the private non-delegation issues. This court held in Rettig and in TOPUC number 2 that an agency must independently review a private party's submissions. Here, the FCC can't even be bothered to issue a separate document approving USAC's numbers each quarter. As far as we can tell, the FCC has never meaningfully changed USAC's numbers. The FCC is, in essence, a passive bystander for this process. The Universal Service Fund's revenue-raising mechanism violates both non-delegation and private non-delegation. Now, the FCC, in response, does raise several arguments. None is persuasive, however. Throughout their brief...
Let me just ask you this. A good bit of your brief is citing dissents as the authority for what you're saying. Can you tell me what the best majority opinion case is for your proposition that this violates the non-delegation?
So if I could, Your Honor, I'd point you to two cases. The first would be National Cable Television. That's the 1974 Supreme Court decision. That also involved the FCC, also involved a fee/tax, also involved, one might say, a technical area of law. In that case, the Supreme Court said that phrases like in the public interest, which might suffice in other areas for non-delegation purposes, will not suffice when it comes to revenue raising. The phrase the court used at page 341 was that puts an agency, carries an agency far from its customary orbit and puts it in search of revenue in the manner of an appropriations committee of the House. So that's the case we think that primarily makes this distinction that we raise between an agency that's been given the power to raise revenue and an agency that's been given the power to regulate some variegated technical matter. The second case I would point you on or to would be Panama Refining from 1935. Now, like the statute here, like Section 254, the statute in Panama Refining had a lengthy list of policies of a sort. There were 10 sections of policies in Panama Refining. Here, there are sections throughout 254 that provide policies of a nature, but when you actually look at them, they're vague, they're precatory, they're not binding. And so within this area, it shows that the agency really does have a wide playing field in which to raise money with very little or no limits whatsoever. Also, another reason for Panama Refining being, I think, one of our better cases, Your Honor, is that it involved a very narrow subject matter. It was only hot oil transported across state lines in excess of state production limitations. That's even narrower than any subject matter limitation in this particular statute, Your Honor. So those are the two cases that I would lay out as, I think, our best ones that are majority opinions. The FCC, in response, throughout its brief, cites its own regulations quite a bit that tie its own hands, it claims, on how much money it can raise. Of course, we know from the Supreme Court's decision in Whitman that those regulations are essentially irrelevant for a non-delegation challenge. All that matters are the limits that Congress itself imposed. The FCC says, well, maybe we don't have the power to raise an unlimited amount of money from anyone for any purpose, but again, under cases like Panama Refining or Jarkissi from this court, or even Schechter Poultry, we know that you don't have to show an absolute power that's been given to the agency. Not even Congress has absolute power. For example, the statute in Schechter Poultry, like the statute here, had an express non-discrimination requirement. So just because the agency literally can't raise any amount of money from any particular entity, that's not enough to defeat a non-delegation challenge. The agency says in response, well, at the very least, we can't raise the rate so high that service becomes unaffordable. But this court addressed that issue in TOPUC number 2 at page 322. The court said, to be sure, the FCC must consider issues like affordability, but that's a procedural requirement. Once the FCC considers these matters, its ultimate substantive determination of how much money to raise, that is a policy-making function, that's the language this court used, that the court can't review. And that followed TOPUC number 1 at page 421, where this court said that section 254 does not limit the FCC's cost calculations. In other words, once the FCC makes up its mind about how much money to charge each quarter, courts can't review it because Congress intended that that policy-making function be decided solely by the FCC. Again, as I mentioned earlier, the government says, well, perhaps in a situation like this, phrases like in the public interest are as good as we could expect Congress to do. But we know from cases like Skinner, which also involved a technical scientific area, pipeline safety, that Congress actually is an expert at setting limits. In fact, this is Congress's perhaps most expert area, setting a limit on how much money to raise. And for example, in Skinner, the statute said that the agency could not raise more than 105% of the amount that had already been appropriated. In J.W. Hampton, the tariff case from the 20s, Congress imposed a statutory limit. The tariffs could not vary by more than 50% from what Congress itself had set. And as I said, it's not just a coincidence that in these cases that involve revenue raising, that there are those sorts of objective limitations. NCTA, the 1974 case, says for revenue raising, it is a little bit different, and there needs to be some sort of boundary there. It's not a high threshold, which makes it all the more unusual that Congress didn't impose one here. The FCC also argues that there are lots of policies in Section 254, but when you read each subsection closely, you'll see that they're not binding, they're aspirational only, there are a lot of shoulds in there, which is significant because under Whitman, anything where the agency has discretion to do it or not do it can't really be considered for a non-delegation challenge because the court said you can't rely on the agency to restrain itself. And even if the court disagrees with these distinctions, the statute here is still unique because of that multi-layer delegation that I mentioned. Here, the FCC has the power to redefine universal service, to add new universal service principles. It's very similar to the statute in that regard in Schechter Poultry, where the executive was given the express power to take from or to add to as he saw fit to affect the purposes of the statute. And so that second layer, where the agency is given a very vague, broad power, and then it has the additional power to modify the scope of its own power expressly by statute, is something that the court pointed repeatedly to in Schechter Poultry as an example for why that statute did not impose clearly delineated boundaries. And this court and the Supreme Court has repeatedly pointed to similar kind of multi-layer issues, multi-layer delegations, multi-layers of review as being especially suspect from a constitutional perspective. For example, Free Enterprise Fund, which involved multiple layers of removal protection, This court's decision recently in the CFPB funding case involved multiple layers of appropriations protection. So that multiple layer issue makes this statute very unusual. The government never points to another statute like that. The only one that we could find was like Schechter Poultry, Your Honors. As I said, that's all before we even get to the private non-delegation issue. This court in TOPUC number 2 at page 328 has already scolded the FCC once for giving, quote, near total deference to private parties' recommendations for how much money to raise for Universal Service Fund. This court said in Rettig there can't be rubber stamping. And here, the FCC, as I noted, doesn't dispute USAC's numbers. The FCC issues no separate approval of USAC's numbers. This all happens on the eve of a new quarter, and so the FCC is really under the gun to accept whatever USAC happens to propose. So for all these reasons, we would say that it violates not just non-delegation, but also private non-delegation. I'd like to address also the government's argument about timeliness, if I could. The government argues that we raise a facial challenge. I would point on that particular aspect to Judge Jones's opinion and Dunn McCampbell, where she says that labeling these sorts of challenges as facial or non-facial is really confusing. The real test, which this court adopted in Texas v. United States from 1985, and as far as I know, every other court has also adopted it, is whether the challenge is to the procedure by which a regulation was promulgated, or is it to the substance of the regulation. The procedural challenges, like notice and comment and that sort of thing, those are going to be strictly barred by the time limit. The substantive challenges, like constitutional authority, for example, those are the types of things that a party can raise whenever the agency applies that old regulation. And I'd also point out that for our core, the pure non-delegation challenge, that's not really a challenge to an old 1990s regulation. It's a challenge to Section 254 itself, to the statute. And so we would say that for that particular aspect, the government's argument about timeliness is kind of a red herring. We're not challenging regulations from the 90s, not for that part. And in fact, remember under Whitman, the regulations for a non-delegation challenge are largely irrelevant. We have to be challenging the statute itself. And there's no statute of limitations for challenging an agency's application of the statute itself, except for the 60 days, which we met. I'd also point out at page 29 of its brief, the FCC says that this entire challenge is timely if there's, quote, an order requiring the company, which in this case would be one of the petitioners, to comply. So in this case, the petitioner that I think is kind of most suited to demonstrate that would be Cause-Based Commerce. This is the company that pays directly to Universal Service Fund. There's no dispute that because of the approval of this one specific quarter, Cause-Based Commerce must pay money directly to the Universal Service Fund. There's no dispute that we have an order here that's a statutory term under Section 402 and also under the Hobbs Act that gives this court jurisdiction. So I would say that even under the government's test, we clearly have an order requiring, at the very least, Cause-Based Commerce to comply. The FCC also relies on the reopening doctrine as a heavy crutch in its brief. That was the only opinion from this court that referenced the reopening doctrine has now been vacated by the Supreme Court, which declined to rely on that. The reopening doctrine is really for challenging policy determinations. An agency made a decision that everyone agrees it could make under its statutory power. One party just doesn't like it, wants it to be changed years and years later. They need to get the agency somehow to kind of re-up that policy choice. And at that point, you could say perhaps it's been reopened and could be challenged. Here, though, we're challenging not the FCC's policy choice per se, we're challenging the FCC's constitutional statutory authority to take the acts it's taken. I think, unless the court has any further questions, we would say that the petition should be granted. I'm happy to take any more questions. As we note in our reply brief, any scope of relief is obviously at the court's discretion. If there are concerns about remedy and how this could be played out If the petition were to be granted, we do note in our reply brief that the court can grant relief solely to petitioners. There are a few consumers who are petitioners. There's one entity that pays directly to the Universal Service Fund. Again, that's up to the court's discretion if we were to reach that point. But otherwise, I'll reserve my time. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Lewis.
May it please the court, Jacob Lewis for the FCC and the United States. Petitioner's non-delegation claims fail because Section 254 sets forth numerous guidelines that constrain the FCC's ability to implement the Universal Service Program. And their private delegation claims fail because the FCC's rules make crystal clear that the Universal Service Administrative Company is simply a billing and collection agent that can, one, make no policy, and two, is subject to the Commission's comprehensive oversight. So it might be useful just to take a high-level view of Section 254, because I think this case begins and ends on an examination of the statute. So in Section 254B, Congress set forth a number of universal service principles that the Commission was to take into account shall base their policies.
Before you get into this, Russ, on the timing issue, I know you raised it.
Yes.
Under Hobbs.
Hobbs Act.
I don't want to say
administrative review.
Are you still pushing that or what?
Yes, I think we have a narrow point here. The odd thing about this case is that this is a proceeding that arises out of the Commission's calculation of the contribution factor. Petitioners don't challenge the calculation of the contribution factor. And indeed, cause-based commerce, which is the only petitioner in the case that actually pays into the fund, the other individuals that have telephone bills, those are charged by their telephone companies. Their duty to pay grows out of the telephone company, but cause-based commerce is a carrier. Its obligation doesn't arise because of the announcement of the contribution factor. There's an invoice that later comes from USAC. And the odd thing about this case is that they have paid that invoice. They don't challenge the contribution. And so if a party is trying to challenge the comprehensive set of the Commission's rules implementing the Universal Service Program, they could have raised every one of these arguments 25 years ago. They did not. Even later on, they can petition the Commission to change the rules or revise the rules, repeal the rules. They didn't file such a petition. There is a narrow exception when the rules are applied to them. In this case, the rules were applied, our position is, when the invoice comes. It's not when the contribution factor for all carriers is announced. When the invoice comes, and here they paid the invoice, and they don't have any argument with regard to the calculation. So that's our point, is they're trying to fit a square peg into a round hole. If they have a beef with the entire system, then they ought to avail themselves of the procedures that allow them to challenge the entire system. And that would have given the Commission and all interested parties an opportunity to participate in that challenge. Instead, they tried to inject these broad-based arguments in a narrow proceeding having to do solely with the contribution factor.
Not to stay bogged down on it, but I understand their argument, notwithstanding what you just said, if he's challenging the constitutional authority of the FCC in this scheme, you know, that can be raised now, as he says, you know, within the 60 days. It's not the appellants wouldn't be limited to having to go back the time period that you're speaking, or said differently, if you were challenging specifically what occurred in those periods, maybe so, but his argument is honest to it. If he's challenging the constitutional authority to do the very things, then that's not time barred and it's timely. I mean, I read what you said.
Excuse me, Your Honor.
I'm just trying to see if that's still a live issue.
I think it's still a live issue. I do think it's been reduced to this point, and maybe it's a narrow point, and we obviously have plenty of arguments on the merits.
All right.
But there, in that respect, their challenge to the contribution factor announcement and the Commission's adoption deemed approval of it was premature, because there was another step that needed to be taken, the invoice, and they had an opportunity when they got the invoice from USAC to appeal to USAC's decision, first to the administrator, this is what set out in the commission's rules, and then to the commission. And so when that's the, if they, and you're right, Your Honor, could they at that point could have challenged, said, look, the whole, that this invoice is based on an unconstitutional system, but it was at the invoice that they should have done. Perhaps it's a narrow objection here, but the contribution factor announcement by itself is for all carriers, and it doesn't, there are some carriers, for example, that don't have enough revenues there. They're just exempt from paying anything. So that further step that USAC takes to decide what the particular amount.
So tell us exactly what you think they should have done if they're thinking that.
They should have either refused to pay the invoice or paid it under protest. There's a commission has a procedure for doing that. And then appealed the invoice, which is an action of the administrator, to the administrator, and the rules say you can appeal, any party agreed can appeal to the commission.
What difference would that really make?
Well, it would have given the agency and other interested parties an opportunity to respond to these arguments instead of plunking down these broad-based arguments in a proceeding that never really had anything to do with the structure of the universal service program. That the commission, as we said, didn't reopen this. The calculation of the contribution factor it's part of our point about the private delegation. It's a very ministerial task. USAC goes out, it gets the data. It essentially puts data in a spreadsheet to the commission. And then the commission reserves the right over the 14-day period to make sure that there is nothing in, say, the demand projections that the commission might want to tweak. It rarely does that because this is a very...
Are you arguing that we should remand this to the FCC? Or because it's a little bit odd because there wasn't anything there to begin with, so remand might not, maybe man.
No, they paid the...
I don't know what the right term is because
I think our
not a remand, really, but...
No, we would dismiss... This is a jurisdictional point. I think they haven't... if this argument...
Right, but typically when we have something that says this should have been raised first in the agency... We remanded to the agency because it started there, but it didn't start there, and so you're saying...
Well, I'm saying in essence, they by paying the invoice not under protest, they would then waive that opportunity.
Okay, so they don't even have that.
No, they don't have that.
But their next invoice, you're saying...
They could do it, yes. They've paid, in fact, they've made a number of subsequent challenges, which they haven't continued to pay the invoice. They haven't protested. Now, the next invoice, if they wanted to pay under protest, then it would go through that process, and the court would get it ultimately.
So procedurally, they'd sort of start over, but at the agency level.
Yes.
That's what you're saying. Okay.
But in any case, I don't want to... We do have, I think, extremely strong merits arguments, and if I could just run through those quickly. The constitutional delegation argument depends on whether Congress gave sufficient guidance to the agency, intelligible guidance, intelligible principle, whether it's set forth an intelligible principle. This is, Section 254 sets forth any number of intelligible principles. And as I was saying—
How does it limit them? I mean, we've all looked at 254. Yeah. How does that limit them? That's what your opponent is basically saying it's not doing.
So in a couple of ways. First, the overarching goal of the program, the overarching a policy is to implement the universal service program. The commission doesn't give the commission power to go off and do anything. So we start from that. But to answer Your Honor's particular questions, in Section 254D, it specifies that contributions to the universal service program, when we're talking about contributions now, the raising revenue, shall be on an equitable and non-discriminatory basis. And that's one limitation. This court in TOPE 1 actually remanded to the commission the commission determination to apply contributions or to require contributions by carriers with international revenues. And in so that particular guideline has bite. It's enough that it's a guideline under the case law, but in fact, it has bite in the sense that this court applied it to say no. By including international revenues, you violated the obligation to have contributions be equitable and non-discriminatory. It's unfair to apply, to require international carriers to contribute on the basis of their international revenues if they would exceed their domestic revenues. And that led to a commission change in its rules. We also point to the Quest 1 and Quest 2 cases in the Tenth Circuit, which again remanded, in part on this same ground, decisions by the commission. But the other thing, the other section I want to point to is 254E. And by the way, D and E both are termed, phrased in terms of shall, not just should. But it says any such support, that is for the Universal Service Program, shall be explicit and sufficient to achieve the purposes of this section. And this court, again, in Alenco, examined that sufficiency requirement and said, look, sufficiency goes both ways. You can't, if it becomes excessive, it would become unaffordable. And so that sufficiency requirement and is another way in which it tamps down, it constrains the commission's ability to just charge and charge and charge freely.
Now, why shouldn't Congress have to put some sort of percentage or dollar limit?
Well, look, they could. There's no question. The Constitution doesn't require it, though. The case law is absolutely clear that what, and case after case, doesn't require a cap. In fact, the court has upheld, the Supreme Court, and this court in Big Time Vapes and in the CFPB cases rejected non-delegation claims on much broader, not concrete, hard cap kind of thing. And by the way, the petitioner's argument that somehow there's something different about revenue raising, that's entirely foreclosed by the Skinner case, which says there's no difference between the taxing functions of Congress or a delegation of Congress's taxing power and any other delegation. The standard remains the same, whether Congress has provided a general policy, an intelligible policy. And the cases that the Supreme Court has upheld, including cases involving the commission, have talked about the public interest, or in Whitman, the public health. And indeed, there is an old case that we cite, not for this proposition, but I would want to point out, United States versus Grimaud, G-R-I-M-A-U-D, from 1911, which involved a forest reservation fee. And again, rejected a non-delegation challenge when the Secretary of Agriculture was given broad authority to impose that fee in order to prevent undermining the purposes of reserving the forest for forest resources. So even as long as far back as then, and for decades afterwards, these kinds of broad guidance to agencies have been held to be constitutional. So you're absolutely right, Judge Haynes. Congress could have put a cap on, but it doesn't require it. The Constitution doesn't require it to do so. This came up in the Yakis case, where it involved wartime price controls, and the same argument was made that Congress should have just set the price limits directly. And the court said there's nothing in the Constitution that requires Congress to take the least or give the agency the least amount of discretion. So the petitioner's argument is just entirely inconsistent with the governing standard for non-delegation and with a fair examination of the multiple ways in which Section 254 restrains the commission.
And so how do you deal with Topic 2 that keeps talking about aspirational and this and that? How does that play into the notion that this does have limits?
Well, first I would say aspirations are good, too. That's another way of saying when Congress gives the agency the aspirations that it's supposed to be going for, that's another way of saying that's the congressional goals. That's the goals of the statute. And so...
Yeah, but is aspirational the same thing as requirement?
I think what petitioners are trying to say is that aspirational is toothless, meaningless. And it's not meaningless. The agency is required to take into account the purposes of the statute. And universal service has been a goal of the commission and of communications law since the creation of the commission. In fact, Section 1 of the Communications Act talks about that the commission was established.
So what's the remedy if they're not being aspirational and they're not meeting the goals? What's the remedy there?
I'm sorry, Your Honor, that if they're not meeting the
rules. I mean, you're saying that there is limits on them.
Yes, right.
Well, that's holding them in. And I'm saying, what happens if they boom out and they're not being held in?
The commission lives in a world of the Administrative Procedure Act. And if the commission is not following Congress's direction, and that Quest case, Quest 1 and Quest 2, and this court's decision in Topic, we get remanded when the court concludes that we are not carrying out Congress's direction. But the constitutional issue was whether or not Congress has given us.
So you're saying they have plenty of avenues to challenge if you're not following the directions.
Right.
But if you are following the directions, their argument that this is unconstitutional is just wrong.
Exactly right, Your Honor. And I guess I'd just say one point on the private non-delegation question. Again, just as the constitutional non-delegation issue is foreclosed by an examination of 254, if you look at the commission's rules, you'll see that USAC has not been delegated any regulatory power. The rules specify that USAC is a billing, collection, and disbursement agent. Essentially, the commission performs a number of accounting or projection data collection functions for the commission.
But what about their argument that you basically just rubber stamp, and in fact, you don't even, you just, it just flops through if you don't do anything?
So that's not exactly true, Your Honor. The commission has on occasion, even with regard to the contribution factor, and they're talking about the contribution factor when they make the rubber stamp argument, the commission has tweaked that on occasion. But that's simply a measure. The fact that the commission has not had occasion to redo the math work that USAC does is simply a measure of that the commission has given them USAC a very straightforward task. And USAC performs that task admirably. So hence the 14 days. The commission reserves a right. You don't need more than 14 days. These are the rules actually specify that USAC is supposed to give their projection demands 60 days in advance to the commission, and the contribution base 30 days in advance to the commission. And then it's just a simple matter of division. So there is nothing, nothing to be seen from the fact that the commission usually does not have reason to check the USAC's math. And on the general supervision point of USAC, the rules specifically say, as I mentioned before, that everybody who's got a beef with the USAC administrator decision has a right to appeal to the commission. And in any event,
so if they got the math wrong, that could be appealed.
Yes, as we said, with regard to the invoice, if somebody picks up their bill and goes, well, wait a second, this seems higher, this seems wrong, and then they go and they say, oh, well, the contribution factor.
So what's the statutory governing principle? What is the statutory governing principle as to whether that is too high?
No, there is no statutory governing principle about when that's too high, except for, all of the principles that are in 254. So if for example, I suppose to take a hypothetical, if somebody picked up their bill and said, well, wait a second, I looked back at everything, and the commission's spending money not on universal service, or it's spending money in a way that's equitable and inequitable and discriminatory, then they could look to make a challenge based on 254. You're not complying with 254.
So you're saying that the substantive limits are inequitable and
the ones that are most relevant to the contributions, the most directly relevant to the contributions, are 254D and E, which talk about equitable and non-discriminatory, that those contribution, every telecommunication carrier that provides interstate telecommunication service shall contribute on an equitable and non-discriminatory basis. That was the standard at issue in TOPA.
What does inequitable mean?
Unfair. And this court applied it in TOPA, is that it was unfair to include the international revenues as part of the contribution base. So it's not, but I also want to make clear that every telecommunication carrier is required to contribute to the universal service support mechanisms. And all of the other provisions of 254, which constrain set forth the policies that the commission is to take into account about the mechanisms, also constrain the contributions in this sense, that the obligation is you're supposed to contribute to the universal service mechanisms. What are those mechanisms? Those are the mechanisms that the commission sets forth, taking into account all of the principles in B and the definition in C. So this all operates as a piece. That it's not just those specific ones.
So it isn't just inequitable or discriminatory.
That's correct. It's also that they have to be sufficient and affordable. That's B1 also sets forth that the rates are supposed to be just, reasonable, and affordable. And I didn't want to take all of the court's time in running the court through each and every provision of 254, but if you look at 254, each and every provision has something that the commission is to take into account. And even down to in B3, for example, that the rates in rural and urban areas are supposed to be roughly comparable and the services are to be, that was again, reasonably comparable was an issue in the Quest cases. So some of these principles are pretty specific, and the ones regarding schools and libraries are also specific. But they all, as a piece, constrain the commission far beyond what we've seen in the Central Securities case, in the NBC case, in the Whitman case, case after case where the Supreme Court has upheld congressional delegations that set forth an intelligible principle. So if the court has no further questions, we would ask.
Let me ask you, counsel opposite at the end of his argument said that, assuming he was persuasive, the remedy would be sort of left to the court. So just tell me, what would be the upshot of the court granting the petition? I'm not saying we would, I'm just trying to understand the other end.
Well, it would be catastrophic and chaotic. We have a universal service program that's been in place for 25 years that serves that provides services to an enormous range of low-income, high-cost areas, schools and libraries that under 254H, this is the internet connections that many libraries have now that people can depend on. If there's no internet anywhere else, they can find it at their local library. And rural health care and telehealth. I think the intervener briefs in this case set forth in quite a lot of detail about how much reliance there's been on this program, which is, again, a basic tenet of communications law and of the FCC's policies from the very beginning. And Congress, that's why 254 is so detailed in its. The one thing you know about 254 is that Congress wanted the commission to continue to support universal service, to establish and maintain mechanisms for supporting all of those important activities.
So someone would just say, well, that's, you're providing too much service, too costly. Where's the governing principle for that? Or this is something you shouldn't be providing?
Well, but the argument has to be that somehow you're providing support that lies outside of the authority that Congress gave you. It's not that that Congress gave the commission an important and a large task. I mean, this is a program that serves satisfies an important and need for people all around the country to have access to telecommunications, even in areas where it would be high cost or not. So that it's not enough to say that it's too much. You have to say it's not authorized by Congress. It's not within the scope of the Universal Service Program. It was Congress's decision to lay out the scope of the problem, the needs, and what it wanted the commission.
Yeah, but they're arguing Congress couldn't do this much delegation.
But that's just wrong, Your Honor. I guess I'd say, looking at the cases, it's precisely the case law makes clear that Congress can do this kind of flexible delegation, set forth the policy, identify the agency that's to implement it, and give an intelligible principle for the agency's actions. And once that's done, if the agency stays within that, there is no argument that Well, I disagree that you should spend that much money for universal service. You have to say that the Congress gave the agency the flexibility, or that somehow the agency under the APA exceeded its authority. They're not making that argument. They're complaining Congress gave the agency too much authority. But the case law makes clear that this is exactly the kind of guidelines and even more so than that the Constitution allows Congress to make.
Judge Haynes asked counsel opposite what was his best non-dissent cases, and he cited two, National Cable Television and Panama Refining. What's your response to those?
So NCTA is not a delegation case, and it was distinguished in Skinner. I think counsel cited it for the proposition that there was a difference between revenue-raising statutes and other kinds of authority. But Skinner quite clearly says that in the delegation area, it's one rule across the board. Doesn't matter if you're talking about money raising or not. In Panama Refining, the court there held there was no guidance. Now, for the hot oil provision, and if you read Panama Refining, which was one of only two Supreme Court cases that have ever struck down a congressional delegation, the court's analysis was that Congress left the administration totally without guidance, or left them unfettered and free. And whatever else you might say about 254, it doesn't leave the commission unfettered and free. It has to act to support the universal service program.
What's the limit on universal services? I mean, I'm trying to, let's say we want to make sure that every household has a color TV with 85-inch screen and 5 phones and 6 cell phones. And is there any limiting principle?
Well, I think this court in Elenco described that limiting principle. It is, at some point, this obligation that the support be sufficient flips and takes into account affordability. If the commission is just going to throw money out the door to support these programs, like you say, flat screen color TV, perhaps, Your Honor, rather than just a color TV, but that would render, the argument would be that would be more than sufficient, it would be excessive, and would violate the statute for that reason. It would violate the principle of affordability. And in the Elenco decision, this court explained that interplay as providing a constraint. So the commission does not have it has the authority and indeed the duty to provide for sufficient support, but not for excessive support. So I think that Your Honor's scenario it wouldn't be consistent with the principles outlined in the statute. If the court has no further questions, we'd ask the petition be denied. Thank you.
On the timing issues, Your Honor, the government says that petitioners could challenge a particular invoice. That's a case-specific action of a company disputes USAC's calculation of what their revenue was in a particular quarter. That's not the mechanism for challenging the contribution factor writ large. I'll point back to the particular statute that gives this court jurisdiction, 28 U.S.C. 2344. It says any party aggrieved by, and then it incorporates another provision, but any party aggrieved by a final FCC order can file a petition in circuit court, and the court would have jurisdiction. The government never disputes there's an FCC order here. They never dispute standing for any of the petitioners, even the particular individual consumers. So that's the provision that gives us standing. That's the provision that shows when there is a final FCC order, a party with standing can challenge it. They don't have to wait until they get an invoice down the road. And the contribution factor that's set every quarter is binding under the regulations the FCC itself issues, 54.703. That's what establishes the obligation to pay once that contribution factor comes out each quarter. It's also a little dissonant, I think, for the government to argue that if we have a beef with the entire system, in their words, that the only way to challenge that is in a case-by-case, invoice-by-invoice manner. The way that that should be challenged is by filing a petition in circuit court after the agency takes final action, issuing an order as it did here with the contribution factor. They also argue that their particular route makes sense because then the public could submit comments. I've never heard of the public submitting comments when a party challenges a particular invoice. I've been submitting comments on the contribution factor docket for over a year. That's the way that it should be challenged, and that's what we've done. Going to the substance here, the government points primarily to 254 D and E, which talk about sufficiency. I would respectfully point the court to TOPUC number 1 at page 412, where the court addressed that and said that sufficiency doesn't mean actual costs the FCC can overcollect. We cite a case in our reply brief from the D.C. Circuit saying the same. This requirement that, requirement in quotes, I should say, that the funding be sufficient, it's not like the word requisite in Whitman, where the Supreme Court interpreted requisite to be a floor and a ceiling. Sufficiency probably in this case doesn't mean either, but it certainly doesn't establish a ceiling. And the government also tries to tie the ultimate payouts from USAC, kind of the payments on the back end, and say that that imposes some restriction on the front end in terms of how much money that the FCC or USAC can collect. But I would point you to the government's own brief, page 60, where they say that the payouts, the distributions, are irrelevant. That's their own word, irrelevant, because the whole case is about the FCC's power to raise money, not about the power to spend it on the back end. They say that Skinner establishes one rule for all non-delegation challenges. Skinner says the intelligible principle is the rule for every non-delegation challenge, but cases like Mistretta and Whitman say that what counts as an intelligible principle will vary based on the scope and nature of the power. And I would also point out, just as a kind of a procedural point, that my distinction between revenue-raising statutes and ones that are more technical, variegated, the government's response brief addresses that only in a footnote on page 38. On the point that they make about TOPUC number 1 addressing intrastate revenues, that's kind of like saying that there's a limit because the FCC can't tax phone companies that operate in another country. That's a jurisdictional restriction that the FCC is presumed to have no authority, no jurisdiction over intrastate matters. They also cite Grimaud from 1911. That's a case, it's kind of like Lichter, which is another old Supreme Court case about non-delegation, that says that essentially when the government's distributing its own property or allowing access to its own property, Lichter was a government contracts case, in those cases, again, a very low threshold would satisfy intelligible principle. I think NCTA, National Cable Television, is the more on point case. That case does involve delegation. They cite to J.W. Hampton and distinguish it. Judge Haynes, you asked what would happen if the FCC went outside of its authority. The examples the government gives are Quest 1 and Quest 2. Those are procedural challenges. The FCC didn't consider something, didn't explain something. This court held in TOPUC 1 and 2 that the FCC's ultimate substantive decisions, once they make them, are not reviewable. Unless the court has any further questions, we request that you grant the petition. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. The court will take a brief recess.